Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One. Just a quick reminder to those that are joining us live, you can scroll down to the bottom of the chat room, bottom of the show page. You'll find the chat room. If you could, roll in there with the usual suspects. If you've got a question you'd like for us to ask or a particular angle you would like for us to pursue with our guests, it's a great place to bring it in. Eagle One and I will both be watching it during the show, so that's a great place to roll in your questions, comments, or points of order as we go forward. And if you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up on previous shows, or you have to leave halfway through and you want to get the rest, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or take the shortcut and just go ahead and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes. And occasionally we will go over our hour. If you're with us live, the audio will stop right at the hour, but it does keep recording. And we will do that on occasion if we have a particular question. We want to make sure we get through with our guest, or if our guest is halfway through a point, we don't want to interrupt them. So you can always go over to the archive, grab the show, and catch the last few minutes that way. Now let's get on with the show. Everybody in the last few years, you read about CENTCOM, the Pacific Pivot, you hear about PACOM, maybe even EUCOM. But there's also NORTHCOM. And in their mission statement, right at the foundation is set really early on, where it states Northern Command's mission is in part to, quote, to provide command and control of Department of Defense, Homeland Defense efforts, and to coordinate defense support of civil authorities, unquote. We'll probably touch on the first bit, but really today, as we get in, as we Southerners like to call it, the meatier part of hurricane season, the second part of the mission, I think, is what we're going to spend a lot of today's show on. And we've got a great guest today to be able to address that. For the full hour, we're going to have as our guest Brigadier General Donald A. McGregor. He's Deputy Director of Operations for Domestic Operations at the headquarters, United States Northern Command, over at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado. General McGregor, welcome to Midrats.
Oh, thank you, Sal. I appreciate it. Enjoy being here.
Again, thanks for the opportunity to come on here to shed some light on what is really an important command here that a lot of people perhaps don't get enough exposure to. Maybe we can shed a little more light on that. As I kind of mentioned on the in the intro, NORTHCOM, it's only a decade old, and a lot of people, they may just think, oh, it's just NORAD under a different name, but it's really not. NORAD's still with us inside the umbrella of Northern Camp. But if you could, please, for the listeners, just give them a brief outline of the genesis of NORTHCOM and what she's doing today.
Sure, Sal, thank you. Actually, October 1st, in a couple of weeks here, we're actually going to celebrate our 10th anniversary for the formation of Northern Command. The genesis of Northern Command was out of the incident in 9/11, where the United States stepped back and took a look at their entire, what I would refer to as their internal security as well as external, but in this specific case, part of our internal security requirements that sort of caught us by surprise, to say. So with the advent of, on the civilian side, and what we'll call the primary agency, Department of Homeland Security was created, and they also needed to have a partner in the Department of Defense that expanded the boundaries of its mission set beyond that of NORAD, which was the aerospace control and warning and maritime warning and basically defense of the U.S., to take a look at a couple of other areas that needed some definitely needed some command and control as far as DOD's effort into that area. So they came up with Northern Command. It is a combatant command, just like Central Command, Pacific Command, and European Command, and Africa Command, as well as Southern Command. So as a result of that, we have got an organization that has been built around essentially three major mission sets, and two of them are highlighted, and one is the essentially the defense of the United States and the approaches to the United States, and we work with NORAD along those lines. As everyone, I think, knows, NORAD is a separate binational command, but it serves under our four-star here. And with Northern Command on the other side, we do a variety of additional mission sets that complement the NORAD mission, such as missile defense. We also cover new cyber issues that are coming up and have developed our own cyber command structure as well within Northern Command. And we also take a look at some of the areas that are on the peripheral that NORAD doesn't necessarily look at as much as a command structure, because there are certain authorities with NORAD. So NORTHCOM was essentially made to cover the defense of the U.S., have a coordinated effort with NORAD, and they also do something else that's very special, and that is defense support to civil authorities. And that is essentially what the Department of Defense would offer if asked to a primary agency such as FEMA or Homeland Security or Customs Border Patrol or even the U.S. Forest Service. We would provide a capability when asked. So floods, wildfires, hurricanes, those types of disasters where when the civilian side of the house down at the local level is either exhausted its resources or does not have a particular capability, it could come up to the Department of Defense and ask for that capability or capacity. And that's where we come in, and we actually take those requests, run it through the system, and then provide that assistance to that primary agency when asked. So that's sort of in a nutshell, Sal, of what U.S. Northern Command does. But we also do something else, and that's security cooperation as a tertiary ability. And we have three primary partners. Obviously, our largest one is Mexico on the southern border. We also work with the Bahamas as well when we do that, and obviously our northern friend with Canada. So it's quite a mission, and it's taken 10 years to evolve, and we're still evolving as we speak, and we'll probably get into some of those conversations later. So other than that, I won't be able to add anything more other than hopefully the questions that come up.
General, when there's a need, when the as you say, that the local authorities have exhausted their capacities and they come looking for help, who do they go to, and who authorizes NORTHCOM to get involved? And then what happens after NORTHCOM gets involved?
Each area, each incident is local, as we always say. So all the way down from the local sheriff's office to the fire department to the police, the city, then the county, then the state, they all go through the incident response, and they do a wonderful job doing that. They've also exercised and organized themselves quite well since 9/11. At that point where they just don't have all the resources or they have a specific capability that does not reside in the state, either at the local, the county, or the state level, and they also realize they come to a primary agency on the federal side. And normally it's FEMA for any type of disaster event. It could be another primary agency as well that's asking for it, like in the wildfires, which is the U.S. Forest Service, through the firefighting center. So once that happens, they will come up to an office. FEMA organizes themselves regionally into 10 regions around the U.S., and what they would do is they have an office there that we have what's called a defense coordinating officer in that office with the federal coordinating officer and also the state coordinating officer. So when a request finally gets up to that point and they're asking for federal assistance, to have all those three members sort of sit around a table and ask who can provide this capability. And if the state is exhausted, then the state coordinating officer will say we can't do it. They'll seek federal assistance from the federal coordinating officer. He may say, or she may say, we can't do this. Is there anything in the Department of Defense that could help? And then the defense coordinating officer at that point goes, I'm going to go through a series of checklists. Does it make sense? Is it viable for the Department of Defense? Are we adequately, do we have the adequate capability in order to perform the mission as requested? And then once that happens, we define it by what's called a mission assignment. And they write this out, and certain people sign it to authorize it, and then they release funding for it as well on the federal side, either through FEMA or the primary agency. And then the Department of Defense takes that mission assignment, and they actually send it here to Northern Command, and it goes into our command center, and then we process it, and then we work with the Joint Staff in the Pentagon, and sometimes the Secretary's office, Secretary of Defense offices, and we make sure it all makes sense. And yes, this is the right thing to do. And then we go and see, go to the services, we get the capability, and then we send it down to help the hurricanes, or we send it down to help the floods, or we send it out to help with the firefighting system. So there's really a very, very strict and rigorous process that we use in order to get all the way from the local request up to the federal request and then into the Department of Defense. And then we have a system within that to do checks and balances to make sure it's the right thing to do and it makes sense to help the citizens and the local authorities.
Well, General, that was a great job of what was probably a 45-minute C2 brief with about 80 different slides.
Well, that would be a first for me.
I felt like I needed a 6-foot by 4-foot whiteboard with 3 different colors. We got to diagram it as we're going through. Yeah, we all love C2. It's a staff weenie's heaven, I know. And speaking of C2 diagrams, something we talked about just briefly on the pre-show, in domestic operations, when people think inside the continental U.S. or somebody in a uniform, they think about the Army National Guard as opposed to national troops. Of course, there are exceptions to that, which is another 45-minute brief. But what type of existing relationship does NORTHCOM have? Because what you described there would seem to be very much directed through, you know, almost like a FEMA-type, you know, civilian infrastructure. But we do have National Guard and Air National Guard in all of our states. And I'm just curious, what type of military-to-military connection is there between NORTHCOM and the different state governors and their Guard adjutant generals? Is there an existing liaison structure in place, or is it a build-to-suit ad hoc situation, which I believe is kind of how you described when a need exists?
Well, first of all, I'd like to go back to, you know, probably maybe, you know, for the person, for the layman who does not understand how requests can go all the way up from the county sheriff and then end up in the Department of Defense, as you said, it would take a whiteboard to try to work through all the channels, but we actually have a very good process in place, and it does follow what's called the National Response Framework, which is a document that lays out almost a civilian doctrine to how best to respond to an event. And everybody from the local county sheriff to the state representative to the federal and to Department of Homeland Security and FEMA have all looked at this document. We've all agreed to the construct. We've all agreed that when it's requested here, it moves up this way. And we've all agreed on when it's asked and it's received, it goes back down and is applied this way. So that document, that National Response Framework, is critical for us to follow, and we follow it to the T. So we work all of our agreements and authorities and processes within the framework of that document, and it is actually a great document, and it's taken a while for us to really work out and iron out a lot of the challenge that go along with that. But to answer the first part of your question, we specifically have an organization here at Northern Command that's within the Director of Operations staff, And we call these Joint Support Force Staff Elements. They're basically, the acronym is JSFSEs. And we do these under what we call preparation and anticipation phasing. So it's basically steady state. So day to day, we have engagements with the states all year long. And these teams that are in Northern Command are the ones that are responsible for the liaison piece that you're referring to. So they're actually, we have three teams here. We have one team in our Army component, and then we have one team that's made up by reservists and then additional staff people. So there's a total of five teams, and there's 16 to 17 members per team. And in each one of those teams, we can actually tailor it to whatever the state requires. So how it works is the state, like let's say Minnesota decides that they want to go and have some assistance from Northern Command. We have already agreed to with the National Guard Bureau that we would take these small element teams and allow what we'll call direct liaison authority into the states from Northern Command to make sure that we work through the channels of communication in the proper order, because technically we're supposed to work through the Bureau. But in this particular case, we've agreed that Northern Command can work directly with the states on a direct liaison piece. So that's an exception to a current DOD directive. So we've worked that out. So what they do is these teams go down, and they help the states put together a joint task force and explain to them how the Title 10 or active component side works, and then helps them shape their joint task force. And we do training, we'll do classroom education, and it's also fitting into something that you may want to ask a little bit later, which is the new dual status commander that's just come up, and I can answer that later. But I'd like to finish with these JSF SE teams. So these teams are the liaison node from Northern Command into each one of those states. And as an example, I would say that we probably engage with the states at least two, if not three times per week, every week, the whole year around, with all 54 of our partners out there. And it is an absolutely wonderful liaison piece we have built in. The states love it. They actually ask for it routinely, and we have developed such a good relationship with them that the recent wildland fires in Colorado and California, the Republican National Convention and Democratic National Convention, as well as the recent Isaac hurricane, were a testament to these teams going out there early and establishing that relationship and helping them build that joint task force to help the state in the integration of Department of Defense active component resources that go into the state to help the local authorities. It's an absolutely fabulous program, and I think it's one of our great feathers in our cap at Northern Command.
Well, as an example of how that works or how it ends up working is when, like, the mobile diving and salvage unit divers from the Navy end up in Minneapolis working to recover people from a bridge that collapsed. Is that part of the process?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, and I want to try to make sure I'm in down at the level that I think your average listener would be able to understand, because, boy, it is really hard in this in the United States to provide Department of Defense resources, and hard in the sense that it's good that it's hard, because it's part of our constitutional boundaries. But if we take the diving example, we would actually use the Defense Coordinating Officer, because that was actually requested out of a primary agency to the Department of Defense, because it was a unique capability that the department had that the did not have in the primary agency. So they went right to the Department of Defense. When that happens, then they go through the Defense Coordinating Officer. And that Defense Coordinating Officer will actually go and build the mission assignment, and then they'll send it up through the system, and then we'll end up with the divers in Minnesota. Now, what the Joint Support Force Staff Element would have done is, because of the relationships that they've built with Minnesota, if Minnesota stood up a task force, local guard task force, to be able to support the event. This group would go in at the local level, guard level, and they would help them receive that force as they come in and they actually start to do their duties. So we have one group called the Defense Coordinating Officer that just basically works out the assignment and pushes the assignment through the process. And then once the divers actually are deployed to Minnesota, then they'll go into the state and they have to go into a organization of command and control, and Minnesota would be the one that would be receiving them. And then the Joint Support Staff Element is the one that would help shape the reception of that group that's coming in. So there's really two areas here. And I would say the liaison teams that I just talked about are the ones who actually go into the state and help shape the reception of forces as they come in. I'm not sure if I helped you out there, but...
I think we're going back to the whiteboard again.
Yeah, this is really a complicated process, but I'll be honest with you. We've done such a great job trying to get it down to reduce the speed of response as well as the process of life-saving capabilities so that, you know, when this happens, all of what I told you all happens literally within seconds and minutes and hours. So it sounds like it's arduous, and in a way it sort of needs to be arduous because we have to make sure that we're doing it within the legal realms of the law, and also respect the constitutional boundaries of the sovereignties of the states. So that's why it becomes very difficult process-wise. But they've worked it out so that they literally have got this thing down to minutes, maybe hours.
Yeah, and I think that's a real point maybe we'll touch on later, that it's arduous for a good reason. It has a right background for it. You know, when you were talking about the intro of the things that the U.S. NORTHCOM does, we have our Canadian friends to the north, and if you ever need to talk to the Canadians, they're all over the place in your headquarters, I know. And we have Mexico to the south, but the sun rises to the east and the west over the oceans. And what role does NORTHCOM have? One of our listeners over in the chat room brought this up. I thought it was a great question. And Ken's interested on the sea approaches. What is the role that NORTHCOM has in the East Coast and the West Coast of the U.S.?
Well, you know, NORAD has maritime warning, and which is different than the air. We actually have air warning and air control under NORAD. But on the maritime side, we only have maritime warning. So what we work out with both coasts is through U.S. Fleet Forces on the east and west side. We have great relationships with them. And through the maritime warning and coordination, they're also monitoring all of the accesses to the U.S. on the maritime as far as control. So between the warning that we get from NORAD and the handoff for control to U.S. Fleet Forces on the east and west coast, we've got a pretty good system in place to be able to handle that, and it seems to work out quite well so far. So it's slightly different than the air piece that we have here.
You mentioned earlier about a contingency dual staffing commander concept. I read about that in a press release that NORTHCOM put out, but I'm afraid I didn't understand it in the press release. Could you kind of go over what that is about and why that's important?
Okay, sure, absolutely. And I do apologize if I'm, you know, sometimes I'll walk down of a command and control rabbit hole, and the average person might get lost in discussion. So please bring me back to something that's a little bit higher in nature. On this dual status commander, this was a concept that was brought out about 6 or 7 years ago. And the reason the genesis of this concept was at the state level, when the National Guard provides resources to an incident at the state, they had under authorities called Title 32 and also State Active Duty. And they controlled sort of, you know, per se, and I have to be careful with my words, that battle space there, helping the local authorities with whatever they needed with troops, such as engineering battalions, maybe some airlift, they could be doing a variety of other support that the guard possesses in that state. Well, we also had, through the defense coordinating officer, when he would get a federal request where it would come up and the state just can't do it, or the state does not have the capability and they actually go to the federal side, then the Department of Defense, if they elect to use them, would come in and we would have our own command and control structure. So essentially what would happen is you would have two command and control structures providing military operations in the state, one on the active component side and one on the state guard side. And not all of them talked to each other. There was not one person in charge of both, which we lacked a unity of effort at that point. It all sort of seemed to work, but we found out in Katrina that it was very problematic. So after Katrina, which really pushed this dual status commander, we have spent the last 4 or 5 years, and as of 2 years ago with presidential signature, they finally made it into law. So now it is the customary way of providing command and control where we will have one officer in charge of both the active component, federal side, and also the guard side under one staff, and then they blend the staffs together. So this is a very, very large effort that took years to get through all of the legalities, and we finally were able to do that. So we have one person in the state in charge when we have an incident that's in control of these task force. And when we bring in the active component, we bring in a Title 10 deputy. And then when we're in the guard, they have a Title 32 deputy. And each one has a reporting chain. One on the state side goes to the adjutant general, and one on the federal side goes all the way up to General Jacoby here at Northern Command. But that one officer is in charge of all of those resources going into the state. And I know for both of you as former service members, you can imagine what a great unity of effort, rather than having two completely different, separate command and control structures supporting the same state with sometimes the same capability, but we have two separate commanders in charge.
Yes, not unlike what we have in Afghanistan, where you ask a question and the answer is, okay, am I wearing my American hat or am I wearing my ISAF hat? Which hat am I wearing? let's take that concept you're just talking about, and let's kind of head off in a different direction here. The largest, most peaceful border in the world are good friends up to the north in Canada. And, you know, a lot of the disaster, you were talking about Hurricane Katrina, you know, a lot of things that are in the southern part of the U.S. that you can't have other ones up to the north. And Mother Nature doesn't respect national boundaries. But even in a higher field like that, if we ever have to pull the O plan off the shelf for a chemical, biological, whether man-made or a natural pandemic, or radiological type of challenge, it conceivably can cross that border. What type of structure do the Canadians have when utilizing their national military that you would have to interface with that is different than how our relationships are with inside of our national borders?
Oh, it's a great question. It's actually quite relevant. I'm sure you've been paying attention to Hurricane Leslie, which is just it's going to run slightly east of the Bermuda, but it may go up into Nova Scotia and hit part of the U.S. at the same time. And also, I think you remember last year when we had Hurricane Irene that walked up the coast and eventually hit Canada. During those particular times, let me talk with our northern border first, because it is different. We have a current agreement with the Canadians, and it's called the Canada Civil Support Agreement. And we have particular processes and procedures that both governments have agreed to allow the exchange of resources across the border, depending on the event, to help, like in search and rescue, to try to help with airlift, to try to help with evacuation. those types of resources, where Canada is very, very capable of handling incidences on their own. But there is times where there's certain capabilities that the U.S. possesses that really, really do come in handy. And these are part of the agreements that we've made to try to get through the legal piece to this, of maybe being able to exchange that resource and really provide it to Canada, and in concert and reciprocating, allow Canada to come into the U.S., because I'm sure you remember during Katrina, they helped out greatly with that event. So we have a really solid agreement in place there. As a matter of fact, we actually may be executing it with Leslie, depending on the direction it goes. But very solid with the Canadians. And I would say that the structure within the U.S. as a federal republic really does not hinder any kind of relationship under that agreement with the Canadians, because it's a free exchange at a national level. It's not an exchange at a state level, even though some of the states along the northern border may have their own state agreements that they've approved through the Department of State with Canada for border purposes. And that those are things that are independent within the state. But this agreement that I just referred to is a national one between the two nations at a national level, and it's very solid. Down to the south, with Mexico, we do not have that same agreement. And it's interesting you asked that question, because during Alex, I don't know if you remember that, but that was a couple years ago, and that hurricane hit smack dab right in the middle between Texas and Mexico. And there was flooding and surge on both sides of the border. The U.S. Coast Guard has an agreement between the two nations that have agreed at the national level to provide resources for search and rescue across the borders and the maritime side. On the maritime side, we are currently now talking about developing the same type of agreement with Mexico that we have with Canada, to see where we could assist each other in trying to resolve some type of natural incident that would be, basically on both sides of the border. And we're right in the middle, right in the process of examining that and working with the government of Mexico and the Mexican military to see where we could actually exchange that, very similar to what we have with Canada. But we don't have that yet. So we do have some challenges down there as far as exchanging resources with the Mexican government. I'm not sure if that helps you, but that's sort of a layout, hopefully to answer your question.
Well, I thought it was a good answer. We've talked kind of about natural disasters, and you just used the word unnatural. Let's talk a little bit about unnatural. I know that NORTHCOM normally does not have large numbers of troops permanently assigned to it, but I understand there is a group that is assigned to NORTHCOM that handles certain specialized matters. Could you kind of discuss that?
Sure. Yeah, I think what you might be referring to is what we call the chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear enterprise, which is the genesis of about, I'd say 4 or 5 years ago, and an agreement between the National Guard Bureau and this command structure that is going to represent a capability for the Department of Defense in case we have an incident in the United States where we would have to respond to such of an event. It was actually a result of a study that they did at the Secretary of Defense level that came out and showed some gaps that we had. And so they elected to go and change the entire command and control structure and some of the life-saving capability to increase it and then reduce the response time by working with the Guard and not working separately. So as a result, the entire enterprise has changed. And matter of fact, we're going to be fully operational capable here 1 October. And in the great news, this is really a great news story, because it really provides an incredible capability for our citizens when asked by the Department of Defense. And again, I want to go back to, if an incident happens in the U.S., such as something is tragic and a disaster level, as a chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear incident, the Department of Defense is not in charge of that response. We still have primary, you know, Department of Homeland Security and agencies within it are part of that response. But we've worked out that there are certain capabilities that are possessed within the military that really assist along those lines, and they developed this enterprise to be able to assist the local authorities, the states, and the federal authorities with this large enterprise that starts all the way down from a guard capability all the way up to a federal capability. And we've coordinated it all the way down the line so that when a primary agency asks for our assistance, we already have in place a capability to respond within a particular time frame, which is rather quick, to that incident with life-saving capability as well as life-sustainment capability. And it's actually a very, very good news story between multiple organizations.
I read an article last week. It mentioned that Lieutenant General Frank Grass just took over as the chief of the National Guard Bureau. And he also had been, I believe, the deputy commander over at NORTHCOM previously. And, I mean, you have a not unusual background to him in the fact that you're actually with National Guard or Reserve, but you're on active duty right now. You have a background as an F-4 and an F-16 pilot, but you also fly for one of the airlines in 777s. How many guardsmen are reservists on active duty do you have at NORTHCOM, and how does that make it function as far as being able to help the communication between the active duty people who may not know what capabilities are in the Guard to be able to tap in there?
That's a great question. Maybe to help you share with you a little bit of my background as I walked into the job here over a year ago. My background is I spent the first 11 years of my career on active duty in F-4s and F-16s, and then went into the Guard and also got hired by United Airlines. So I did what we call a traditional member, which is a part-time member in the Guard, and I did that for about 10 or 11 years, and then actually went on active duty as a guardsman and went over to Europe. And I spent 5 years in Europe working all types of issues with European Command and United States Air Forces in Europe as a guardsman on active duty. And then I got pulled into Washington, D.C. to work into the Pentagon and Andrews Air Force Base in the Air National Guard and what we call the National Guard Bureau, sort of the headquarters for the National Guard, if you want to call it that, even though we can't technically have a headquarters. It functions that way. And as we were going through, I ran the domestic operations for the Air National Guard as part of one of my portfolios. I was the director of operations for the Air National Guard. And they wanted to develop a position here to strengthen the relationship of what you just discussed between the National Guard and Northern Command. So they actually added a position and put me in it and sent me out to Northern Command here last year. And so my job here is really sort of the domestic support to civil authorities, if you want to call it, expert, and I also oversee a lot of the, and the short name is called DISCA. I run all of the DISCA effort for the command, along with a couple of my other officers who run the some of the orders process, et cetera. But I do sort of the operational strategic look for this command. So what that does, you know, circling back, is I've seen the guard side and how they work, and now I'm at the active component side and seeing how Northern Command works. And it has been very helpful to help shape that relationship on how the Guard works and then how Northern Command works, especially since we have started this dual status command authority, where we're actually working under one officer for both active duty and the state. So it's really helped sort of tie the knot between the two, and especially under the Director of Operations, where everything is moving. You know, it's sort of your big appetite as operations. It's one of three general officer positions in Northern Command that are guardsmen on active duty. and we have one also in logistics area, and then we have our deputy, who is now, our new deputy is Lieutenant General Doobie, who's come from the state of Vermont and was a former adjutant general there, and now he's the deputy of this command. So we're really actually starting to increase the relationship between the Guard and Northern Command through these general senior level officer positions. And also below the senior level officer, you know, at your colonel, lieutenant colonel, and major, we have quite a few dozens of positions that the Guard fills, and also the reserve component, the reserve fills as well across the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines. So both the reserve side and the Guard side are well represented here, and it really just provides what I'll call a very balanced approach to how we support our civil authorities in the United States. I think it's a wonderful concept, and it's actually growing. I hope this helped.
Well, it also, I saw recently that the U.S. has a retired reservist. Of course, I'm interested in this, that the reservists are now going to be allowed to do disaster response. Are you going to fold them somehow into the structure that NORTHCOM has developed, or is that going to be more, I mean, I don't know how, it can't be ad hoc. You just can't have a bunch of crazy naval reservists running around.
We watch the Navy, that's for sure. No, I'm just kidding. It's a great question. You know, you're actually asking such relevant questions. We're right in the middle of doing what we call our total force sourcing solution, where we're going to examine exactly what you said, where we actually take the reserve component as well as our guardsmen and our active duty members, and we figure out what is the best way for us to either allocate resources or present forces to the disaster that makes sense. So that we don't, we don't get one particular capability that we have an incident in California and we're flying people out from Maine to try to go and support the incident. We'd rather have a local installation down in California that may be a reserve, Navy reserve installation or a Marine reserve installation or a guard unit that's already down there and find out, hey, what's the best way that they're already there, they have the capability, how do we get them into the battle space, and what makes sense rather than trying to fly people, you know, thousands of miles, and that increases your speed of response problem. So that's one aspect of it. Now, you did mention something about what I will call the mobilization, the new mobilization law that came in last year. And, you know, if for anybody who, you know, wants to go up under titled code, it's called 12304 Alpha. And what they did through the National Defense Authorization Act last year is they said, historically and by law, actually, entitled code, the reserve component could not be mobilized to participate in a natural disaster. And they thought that that was not a, they thought that was a hindrance and a vehicle to try to get the reserve component to at least be mobilized during a major event and allow the access to the reserve component to participate in a natural disaster. It doesn't mean that they were not participating. They were participating, but they were participating voluntarily. And what this does is this actually allows the Secretary of Defense to mobilize them if we have a major event so that we give those local commanders in the reserve component the authority to be able to go and tell the member that, hey, you've got to come into work here and you're going to go and support this disaster. Not that they wouldn't, but it really gives that additional authority to the commander to mobilize them when we really do need them. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at particular capabilities to see whether we've got, for example, I'll give you a great example here. In the Aero Medevac, where we actually use C-130s, sometimes C-17s, but we use C-130s, to actually go and pull people out of hurricanes prior to the hurricane hitting land, where we've got nursing homes, hospitals, some critical care people that because of the speed of the hurricane coming in and because everyone is exiting the area, all the lines of movement are already clogged up and they can't get the people out. We'll actually take C-130s, fly them in, and then we will put people on the back of them, and then we will fly them out. And we can fly hundreds out per day doing that, and that is part of a role and responsibility for us here. And actually, you know, it's interesting. We get that capability from the same group that goes into used to go into Iraq and now Afghanistan and pull these soldiers out, and it's called Aeromedical Evacuation. That group, 90% of the resources for that group reside in the reserve component. Between the reserves and the guard, 90%. So the active duty only possesses 10%. So if we had a hurricane in Texas and we wanted to pull people out of Galveston Island and that request came up, we would have to have, you know, undeniable access to those guardsmen and to those reservists to make sure that we can get them into Galveston to pull them out. What this law does is it now allows the Secretary of Defense to mobilize that resource to be able to get them into that area and help and assist. And that's really what it does. So that's part of where we're going with this is if there's a particular capability that resides predominantly in the reserve component, this authority really gives the Secretary of Defense and now General Jacoby at Northern Command an ability to reach into that organization and get them to come and help with the disasters. It's a pretty good tool.
When we were talking earlier about the hurricane that may be heading towards the Canadian Maritimes and also the hurricane that hit right on the Mexico-Texas border, one thing that popped into my mind, especially being a southerner, a lot of times we think that the closest to our maritime neighbor is down there at Key West at 90 miles to Cuba, but it's actually not. The difference from mainland between Alaska and Russia is just 53 miles, and I think it's just a couple of miles between Big Diomede and Little Diomede Island. And back in 2011, there was the equivalent of a hurricane that hit up in Alaska, and they get some pretty nasty storms up there. We have a good relation with the Canadians. We can do better with the Mexicans. But when it comes to responding to national disasters or maritime emergencies, how has our coordination with Russia been?
Well, you've done your homework, haven't you? You're asking such great, relevant questions. We're actually going through the process of examining, we have a joint task force in Alaska that works for General Jacoby, but he also wears a few hats. He also wears Alaska Command hat, but that command hat actually works for the Pacific Commander. So we have a challenge with working out between General Jacoby and the Pacific Commander on how we're going to use that organization to assist with either natural disasters, assist with search and rescue within those natural disasters, and also developing a relationship nationally and internationally with, for say, the Russians, for an example. When we work with somebody outside of the U.S., whether it be Mexico and or Canada, outside of NORAD, because that agreement is already in place, but if we were to work with Russia, we would have to go through the Department of State, and we would have to develop an agreement with the Russians in that area to be able to exchange resources with helping the Russians during a disaster or an event. And we're just going through the initial process of examining exactly how all that would possibly work out. But currently, we really don't have an agreement in place other than through, a reactionary piece through the Department of State on how to work with the Russians in that area through Alaska Command. What I can't answer for you is what Pacific Command has done with that other hat that the three-star uses up there. They may have a far more robust relationship with the Russians and agreements that unfortunately, I can't answer for you. But as far as Northern Command and General Jacoby, we currently do not have that under Joint Task Force Alaska as we speak right now.
One of the listeners in the chat room posed a pretty good question about the communications infrastructure that would be used for the kinds of operations that NORTHCOM is involved in. It's been my experience that communications is almost always the weakest link in any adventure we undertake with large numbers of people. Is there an infrastructure in place, and how robust is it?
Well, if let me ask you a question just so I can go down the right path. In the question from the listener, were they referring to the response to an incident like a natural disaster?
Yeah, I think that, you know, he's talking about these types of operations, and I'm gathering from that, you know, on the ground we've got the normal, you know, you've got your incident commander and he's working his way up through the radio and telephones and all that. How are they communicating? You know, let's assume that you've got something fairly widespread, not an EMP thing, but something that is going to, a hurricane that's knocked out a lot of phone lines and stuff. What kind of structure is there to get word up to you all to help make calls and what assets to send down?
Oh, that's a great question. That one I can't answer. We have, I call them the urban assault vehicles. We actually have via communication vehicles with a wide variety of suites, both classified and unclassified, that are capable of basically going into a state and setting up a separate communication node to be able to go from the incident to the state or from the incident up to the federal authorities and up to Northern Command. And we have a few of these vehicles, and as a matter of fact, we exercised those during Hurricane Isaac in the state of Louisiana. And I'm not sure if you knew this, but as a hurricane comes up, because of the mass flooding and a lot of the damage that the wind produces, a lot of the cell towers literally go down. So absent of Verizon, AT&T, or Sprint trying to get their systems back in place, or their own plan to try to mitigate that particular piece, there will be times within the military side of the house where they have to get communication from a central parish in Louisiana that has got excessive wind damage, all the cell towers are down, and they literally cannot communicate other than maybe a handheld ICOM radio that has a limited distance. These vehicles can actually go in there, and we pre-positioned them in Louisiana through the approval and authority of the Adjutant General for Louisiana. And at one point, for I think up to 3 days, they were used exclusively to communicate between the local incident and the state as far as getting the right resources back down to the incident to help with the assistance, whether it be an engineering piece that was needed, whether it would be a distribution piece for water or food, et cetera. Those vehicles were critical in trying to get that accomplished. And so during this, I'll go back to these joint staff support elements at Northern Command that go into the states routinely. We have one of those vehicles. We work with the states quite often. We exercise with them. We set up communication nodes, sometimes completely independent of the infrastructure there, so that we can work basically almost bare base operations with the communication. Now, if we have it widespread across multiple states, we do have limited resources. But we do have the capability, and I'm not sure that helps with the question, but we do have a communication tool and literally a vehicle that sets up communications all the way up to this command and the primary agencies as well as the states.
No, I think that answers the question. I like the strike reference, too. So
I just like the concept of having a fighter guy look at somebody and say, launch the ready Winnebago.
As long as it's got a joystick, I'll be good.
Yeah, that just controls the DirecTV antenna. The going to something a little more serious, and we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but in our country at least, we've got a couple centuries plus of our best legal minds trying to put in their proper boxes the role of the U.S. military on U.S. soil. And we come to the 21st century where we have the old challenges, but we also have new ones on there, whether you're looking at cyber attack, various transnational, non-state actors. But you mentioned ABM anti-ballistic missile defense. A lot of that depends on where it's coming from. I know we covered this in the Cold War, but that's going over Canada. And also there's I know this has been war-gamed quite a bit, but there's also the very unique thing that we haven't seen since the U.S. Civil War, where we would have inside CONUS internally displaced people that would be the natural byproduct of any type of CBR attack here. How has the legal beagle, the JAGs over there at NORTHCOM, what are those areas that they feel they still need to get tied together from a legal concept to really be able to give the commander the best legal advice possible for these types of hard issues?
Yeah, I will try to best cover within my capabilities here with information on the, what we would call a unnatural or man-made disaster. There's quite a few institutions in place at the federal level outside of this command that will be used to help support and respond to that type of incident. And they're all within the legal realms that they've worked out through either congressional law or within, worked out between the states. Our piece to that I talked about earlier and some of the laws that we had to work through in order to make sure that when the primary agency asks for our help with that type of event, that we can legally go into the state knows we're coming in, and the state accepts us coming in, because we have to make sure that within the constitutional boundaries and the legalities is that no federal resource goes into a state without the state asking for it and accepting it. And this is something that we're very, very careful, no matter if we're sending a staff element team in or we are sending an entire chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear capability in. We have to make sure that the law and the legal boundaries are always covered. And I will tell you, when I'm running operations here, for example, if we have a response to a disaster, I literally have a speed dial to the judge advocate's office. And that is to make sure that we're all within the legal boundaries of providing that federal assistance into the state. But the good news story about this, and maybe where you were going with the question, is that we've made a lot of changes after 9/11, and I think very positive changes that still protect our Constitution, still protect the sovereignties of the state, and allow a better relationship with the state, and I would say a better ability of the state to ask for that federal assistance. That, in part, was what was missing before, is the state actually just went and handled it by itself, and then we ad hocly put a federal piece in when it reached a breaking point, and we realized after Katrina and 9/11 we just can't operate that anymore. So we're not the 800-pound gorilla walking in. I don't want the listeners to think that this is a big federal push of resources into a state. What we've done is we've done, through coordination with the states and acceptance by the states, certain liaison authorities and abilities to talk directly with the states. We've developed this national response framework that everybody agreed to and said, when this happens, here are the triggers, and here's your ability to provide resources into the state. And we've come so far in our ability to do that we've actually shortened the response time significantly from literally days and days of an ability for a federal resource to get into a state to now we've gotten to it that the agreements of the state and the acceptance of the state is literally within hours that we can get federal resources in there. It's really a great news story. But the bottom line, and at the end of the day, even if they ask for it, and they elect not to have it for whatever reason, and this has happened several times, they can say, I do not want you to come into the state, and we stop. We immediately halt and go back to the installations, and we get ready for the next request coming in. And that an example of that is the state initially requests, for example, search and rescue helicopters. We pre-position them. We get all through the legalities, and we get through the funding and assistance. And then the state finally goes, well, we decided not to have you come in because we already have the resources. We picked up some additional resources over in this other state to come in and help us. We no longer need you. Then, boom, we stop. So there's always that road, that line that we draw on the sovereignty side of the state that we're very, very careful with and that we recognize and we respect highly.
General, it's been a very fast hour. I want to thank you for appearing on our show today. I've got about 500 more questions I could ask about NORTHCOM, but I think we're going to let you go and enjoy the rest of your afternoon. And really appreciate you coming on. Is there anything else you'd like to tell our audience before we sign off?
I'll tell you, this is a great command, and it's one of our great news stories for our nation that we were able to develop a command structure that allows a unified defense of the United States within a very, very difficult area because of recognizing all of the constitutional and sovereign issues of the state, but still being able to protect the boundaries of the U.S. and working with primary agencies. It has been a work in progress for 10 years. It's going to get better. But I'll tell you, where we were 10 years ago to where we are today is just a fundamental difference and actually a great news story. So if there's anything I can leave with the listeners, this is just a fantastic command. They're doing great work.
And thank you very much. I just echo what my co-host says. It's been great for you to come here. And our guest today has been Brigadier General Donald McGregor, Deputy Director of Operations for Domestic Operations over at the headquarters for U.S. Northern Command at Peterson Air Force Base, Colorado. Hope you have a great week, General.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your invitation.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us, and we look forward to talking to you next week. Until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy, and for our guests, we'll even throw in the Air Force Day for you. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly.